Hi, Year 11s. Mr. Shirley here again to talk to you about Ozymandias in my echoey kitchen. So Ozymandias is a poem that a lot of people seem to remember very well, because there's some easy quotes to pull from it. But unfortunately, it seems like a lot of students are not really picking out the most salient and important parts of the poem. So I'm going to go over some of the things about Ozymandias, which, kind of separate you from your analysis of it from everyone else. So Percy Shelley was actually one of the most important romantic poets of his time, along with Wordsworth. Him and Wordsworth were really pioneers of the romantic era, especially romantic poetry. And his ideas, as well as ideas, his romantic ideas, sorry, really show up in this poem. One of them being the way that humans are situated within nature and the way we experience things such as the sublime. What does sublime mean? Good question. S-U-B-L-I-M-E, if you want to double check the spelling. Sublime means an experience of extreme awe, something that the romantics would have really been interested in. The sublime was especially those kind of awe-inspiring moments that there was, it's, it feels like are ineffable. Like there's no way of actually putting them into words, that they're an experience beyond anything else. That's what we mean when we say the sublime. And if you think of a sublime experience from the prelude, that moment in which he is so terrified by the huge peak and the way that it affects him afterwards and changes his perspective of his place in the world, that's sort of a sublime experience. And Ozymandias is kind of trying to teach the same kind of a sublime moment to readers. So just to get the basics out of the way, Ozymandias is a sonnet, which means it is composed of 14 lines with a regular rhyme of ABAB all the way through, and then ending with a rhyming couplet with the words bear and away, kind of messing that up. So the poem starts with, well, really, if you think about it, only the first line and then the two words, who said, I met a traveler from an antique land who said. Those are the only actual words that come from the poet. The rest is an oral account passed down from that traveler from the antique land. And that seems like it's a really insignificant detail until we get into the way that Shelley actually develops the ironies in the poem. So the ironies, in this case, what we mean by irony being something that is said, but because of its context, has a very opposite and different meaning to the people who hear it. The main irony of this poem, as I was saying, is the words that appear on Ozymandias's pedestal, where he says, my name is Ozymandias, king of kings, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. And by using those words of Ozymandias and framing them inside of, first of all, that they're on the pedestal, and then second of all, that they're coming from the traveler's words, and then third of all, that they're within the poem, it really creates this layer that distances Ozymandias. And since one of the kind of key messages that can be taken from the poem is the way that time strips us of power and takes us away from power, the distancing of Ozymandias' words by hiding them further and further inside of the poem kind of symbolizes the way that time does that, that it strips us of our power. Because, for example, the king's words are put inside of all these other layers where the irony is developed and his words don't actually mean that he has power. They mean the exact opposite. It's a moment for us to kind of laugh at his arrogance. So that's one of the first important points to really get about the poem. That main irony of his statement about how powerful he thinks he is developed by the way that Shelley has structured it through a sort of oral tradition. The fact that the poem's passed down from the traveler and then passed on to him into the poem. Like I said, the further we go in time, the further into the poem we go, the more it kind of emphasizes the way that Ozymandias really isn't as powerful as he says he is. that the distance that it takes us to get to the actual message through all these different speakers emphasizes the irony of him losing his power. Or sorry, him losing his power and the irony of him ever saying that he wouldn't lose his power. There's obviously a lot of language choices that Shelley uses to kind of emphasize the way that Ozymandias doesn't have power. His statue is described as, while it is vast, it's described as trunkless. If you think of the trunk as the most stout and strongest part of a tree, for example, the fact that his statue has no trunk really emphasizes the fact that there is no central power to him anymore. Also, there's words like half-sunk, shattered, that also kind of emphasize the fact that he has lost his power. But it's not just the way that the statue is described that emphasizes the fact that he has lost the power. It's also the fact that there is a sculptor in this poem that has power over Ozymandias. That seems a little bit weird, but let's just go over those lines. So, near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. So one thing you really want to notice there is that rather than just describing, rather than just describing the statue as being destroyed with the words trunkless and shattered, like we said, the fact that there is this sculptor who was, did such a good job of reading the passions, the qualities of Ozymandias, that his work still survives is an even stronger irony, that the power of Ozymandias hasn't even surpassed his own servant, the sculptor, who would have been working for him. So there's a reversal of power in this case, where Shelley is describing the works of the sculptor as being well done and surviving to really heighten the fact and make us realize how much Ozymandias was mistaken when he calls himself the King of Kings. Now, one of the poem's messages definitely is about the awe that nature inspires in us, that it is able to destroy a civilization which once was there and now is only a colossal wreck, boundless and bare, by the end of the poem. That's a typically romantic experience of realizing mankind's situation and the way that we are positioned in nature, that nature and time actually destroy us, so that in the end there's only the land, the lone and level sands. Also, though, the significance of the sculptor can also be said to be kind of getting home a message about the importance of art. The romantic poets like Shelley and Wordsworth were really interested in the way that art has a role in human experience and interacting with that awe-inspiring, sublime thing that nature causes. So the fact that the sculptor's work, which we could see as a kind of art, survives past Ozymandias is really important and something we say is typically romantic. Shelley is not just talking about the human position in the world and the way that all our power will be taken away in time and things like that. He's also talking about the power of art, the power for art to create an immortal sort of thing. We don't really think about it too much when we think about this poem, but the fact that the sculpture survives in some ways, but Ozymandias hasn't, is really important. It shows the, like I said, the immortality of art and the fact that art survives beyond us. This can also really be seen in the fact that this poem in and of itself is a piece of art. And the fact that the poem about Ozymandias and the sculpture of him survive longer than he does is really important. And really draws home the message that Shelley might be sending about the power art has. This goes back to the whole thing about irony that I was talking about to begin with. The statement, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." In one setting, at the time when it was originally said, had a certain meaning. But because it has been passed through all these layers, going forward in time, being told by the traveler, and now put in this poem, there's a deep irony in that statement, because we all understand that the opposite is actually true, because of the trunkless wreck of his statue. Overall, then, with Ozymandias, Shelley isn't just using irony to talk about the way that humans lack power ultimately, and the way that there's things like nature and time, which have far more control over us. He's also using that irony to show the power of art. The poem is titled Ozymandias, and you would think that a poem named after you would be a praising thing, would be something good. But in this case, it's really using Ozymandias as sort of a punchline to send another message entirely about how Ozymandias himself isn't important, but rather art and the ability to immortalize things and immortalize meaning. That is what is important. And the way that Shelley really takes the message away from being about Ozymandias and human power is that moment of anticlimax after Ozymandias' statement, with the short sentence, "Nothing beside remains." So he's used that sentence to really punctuate and create a pause in the poem to really focus our attention on the fact that, no, Ozymandias is not the King of Kings. Nothing remains. Now, another interpretation you could possibly take from this comes from the fact that Shelley, along with some other romantic poets, I wouldn't say all of them for sure, but definitely Shelley, was openly atheist, something that would be a little bit controversial at the time. But the fact that he's using he has Ozymandias using the rather biblical reference, King of Kings, and then showing how this King of Kings has been had his power taken away, the fact that he's using this biblical reference about the King of Kings and then taking the power away from this person might be suggesting that something along the lines of, you know, our gods and King of Kings that we call kings today will also lose power. So we could see that as also a way that he's really showing how myth and religion and the power that we put in those forms and the powers that we give to figures like gods and whatnot is really only contextual. And that maybe there's a suggestion that he's thinking even God, even Christ, where we get the line King of Kings from, even he is not really a powerful figure at all. And that in time, as his words are distanced from us, just like the words of Ozymandias have been, we'll realize how ridiculous it would be to ever make that statement that there is one true God or one true power, rather than this overwhelmingly powerful thing called time that we don't have any way of understanding, other than just seeing the way that it lays waste to even the most powerful, like Ozymandias. So, if you sat through this and the bayonet charge one, wow, that's a lot of time. I can't believe I even spoke that long. Enjoy. Bye.